Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Everybody, this is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our Day 6 coverage of the 2017 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio on KVRF 89.7 in the Mat-Su Valley. Make sure you check us out on social media. We update throughout the race. You can find us on Dog Works Radio. You can also find me over on Twitter at Robert Forto, and calling in from California is Alex Stein. His name is Coldfoot Films on Twitter. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. We're in a very, very interesting part of the race, and we talked a little bit yesterday about how the mandatory rests were going to really start to come into play, and that's definitely something that we're seeing play out today, and I would imagine over the next day or so. That's going to continue to be a big, big factor, both in terms of the leaders, the standings, and all of that.
Right. Currently on the leaderboard, Wade Mars in first, but he has not taken his eight-hour break. Mitch Seavey, Dallas Seavey, Yor Olsom, Pete Kaiser, Nick Pettit has taken his 8 and 24, Richie Deal, Ray Reddington Jr., Ali Zirkel, and Jesse Royer round out the top 10, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of those still have that 8-hour break to go, don't they?
Yeah, and so it's very interesting. I was watching the tracker this morning, and Wade, Mitch, and Dallas are now in Koyukuk, and the rest of that crowd, the top 10, bunched around the top 10, are on their way between Hooslea and Koyukuk. And in particular, Nick Pettit, Ray Reddington Jr., Ali Zirkel, and Jesse Royer, who are all between Hooslea and Koyukuk, have taken both their 8 and their 24. So
right.
Wade and the Seavies are going to have an 8-hour layover at one of the remaining Yukon River checkpoints. But theoretically, Nick Pettit, Ray Reddington Jr., Ali, and Jesse Royer, since they've already completed their 8-hour layover, they can theoretically at least gain a lot of ground in the next day or so. So even though Ali is currently about 50 miles behind, and Ray's about 40 miles behind Ray Reddington Jr., since they don't have to have that additional eight-hour rest, I would think that they or perhaps Nick Pettit or Jesse Royer would be able to jump forward and take the lead in this race.
You know, I was thinking last night, Alex, after you and I got off the air and we were trying to figure out all this Iditarod math, you know how easy it would be on this chart on Iditarod.com if they just put one more column, total time on the trail, because that's what matters in the long run. If a person finishes at 9 days, 23 hours, and 59 minutes, and the next person is 10 days and 2 minutes, it doesn't matter who's taken what break where, that would be real easy to figure out if it just had a total elapsed time. What do you think?
It sounds like a great idea, and I would think that would not be all that difficult to program in and do automatically. There's the standings column on Iditarod.com is basically looks the same pretty much as it has for the last 15 or 20 years.
Right.
There's an additional column on the end now for insights, which is, you click on it and it tells you what the fastest time for a particular leg of the race is, But yeah, I would think it would not be that difficult theoretically to add something like that.
So we've also had one excuse me. We also had one scratch overnight, Mark Sealand. He scratched in Ruby, and then we typically, this is when we start talking about the back of the pack mushers. Currently in 69th place, the Red Lantern holder at this point is Ryan Anderson, then Ellen Halverson, Roger Lee, Cindy Abbott, Jimmy Lebling, and then way back in the back, I misread there. I thought it said Martin Bucer, Michael Baker. So we in the last five back there, we have one, two, three, four. In the last six, we have four rookies. So that's not unusual, is it?
No, not at all. And actually, Ryan Anderson is going to be our musher profile today. So we'll be talking a little bit more about him. It is not at all unusual to have a bunch of rookies towards the end of the race. And there are a lot of reasons for that. For many of these rookies, the Iditarod is the longest race that they have done. In some cases, they've done other races that are 1,000-mile races. There are some rookies who've done the Yukon Quest, for example. But most of them are racers who have done 200-mile races, maybe a 300-mile or a 350, but they've never done a 1,000-mile race before. And it's a very different thing to prepare for and plan for and then carry out your run for a 350, for example, than for a 1,000-mile race. There's just a lot more things that can happen and a lot more stuff that you have to take into account. And this isn't a criticism of them. And a lot of rookies who run very much toward the back of the pack will, if they come back, they'll have learned a significant amount and they'll do better the next time they run. But there's just a lot of unpredictable things that you run into in a race this long, as well as a lot of, frankly, a lot of things that maybe you can let slide on a shorter race that will come back and haunt you in a much longer race.
You know, I totally agree with everything you just said. And again, even back at the back of the pack, people have that race strategy all worked out. Because if they don't, and we've talked about it a lot over the years, even though they are in the Red Lantern position or a couple of positions huddled around there, they still have to pay attention to the clock because very quickly time can get away from them and they can be disqualified, can't they?
Yeah, and you know, there's a rule. There used to be specific times that you would have to be within the leaders, and now it's a more general description that you just have to be in a position of competitiveness, I think is the way it's worded. But the infrastructure of the race sort of goes down the trail, and when there is someone who's significantly behind, that becomes complicated for the Iditarod as an organization because they have to keep the checkpoints open, they have to keep volunteers and vets and people there waiting for that last musher or those last few mushers. So as it gets longer into the race, if people start falling significantly behind, there is a risk that they can be disqualified for no longer being competitive.
Well, speaking of that, I'm looking here at the standings at Ryan Anderson's time for rest in the checkpoint. He was in Ruby for 39 hours and 4 minutes. And I assume he took his 24-hour break there, but that's over a day and a half there in a checkpoint that's separated quite a few miles from the lead of the pack there, who we talked about Wade, Mitch, and Dallas way up in Koyukuk. that's a very interesting strategy there to spend that much time after a 24-hour break in one checkpoint. That sounds like almost a Dawson City rest on the Yukon Quest.
Yeah, and you know it's, and I'm not sure exactly what was going on with the decision to do that, except to say that you know that's a very unusual amount of time to spend in a checkpoint, and often when someone is spending that much more time than what's required, it can be a you know, a signal that there is something wrong with some of the dogs, or something wrong that's keeping the musher from just going forward. And you know, frankly, a lot of times if you are able to give dogs a little bit extra rest, some of the time, if there's a minor problem, it will work itself out with a few more hours.
Well, one last thought on that long break there with Ryan. He's left Ruby on his way to Galena, but Ruby is at 346 on the trail, and Koyukuk is at 564, so 218 miles further down the trail from the leaders. That is a significant amount of trail distance, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And yes, I'll just leave it at that. It's a very big difference.
All right, so we do have a little bit of sombering news. Last night we talked about Deacon that passed away on the trail the day before he collapsed on the way into, I believe it was into Galena on Seth Barnes's team. And now we've had another dog pass away, very interestingly, on the plane ride back from Manly to Fairbanks. What do you have on this situation?
Yeah, so this is a dog that was dropped because there was, I believe it was a wrist problem. So the dog had a sore wrist and wasn't able to continue. The dog was dropped, and then it was being transported back to Anchorage. And what usually happens is the dogs will stay at a checkpoint for a while until there is space on a plane to bring them back to Anchorage, or sometimes to another checkpoint like McGrath or Unalakleet. On the way, getting the dog back to where it can be reunited with the representative of the kennel, and this dog was died en route. So presumably, I believe it was on the plane that this happened. And these are, you know, these are small planes driven by pilots for the Iditarod Air Force, and it is, you know, the dogs are not, you know, they're not strapped in or in seats generally. They're generally loose in the planes. I'm not really sure what the circumstances are that caused this to happen to the dog, and there will be a necropsy. I literally can never pronounce that word. There, that will be performed on the dog, and we'll presumably know more in the future. But this is obviously a very, very sad situation, and it's anytime a dog dies, it's sad. But in my mind, it's almost sadder, because the musher has turned the dog over to the Iditarod for safekeeping and to be transported back. So it's not like the dog died running the race. The dog died after it was officially out of the race, but before it was reunited with its owners.
couple of pieces of information in regards to drop dogs and racing. It's my understanding on Iditarod, like with many other races, the dog is under the care of the veterinarian for 24 hours after it is dropped and is at the checkpoint or picked up or at the holding spot or picked up by the handlers or the owners of the dog, or until the race is over. So if a person finishes today, technically they're still under the direction of the veterinarian up till a day afterwards, mainly because of things like this. Secondly, this dog was transported in an airplane in a crate, very similar to how you would transport your dog if you were flying here or there on an airplane, but it's just on a much smaller aircraft compared to what you're typically flying on. And also, a lot of times, Alex, I know you've seen the pictures of this, that they will literally bag up the dogs in something very similar to a drop bag, and it'll just have its head poking out, and it will be kind of Christmas packaged up so that they're easier to transport, so they're not bouncing around in the plane, and they're able to have more dogs in the plane at one time. So they do that as well. But then again, a lot of times they're just sort of there hanging out in the plane and getting from one point to another. And you would be surprised just how well most sled dogs get along. Now, there's always a scuffle or a tiff, but very rarely are there knockdown, drag-out fights because these dogs are around so many dogs all the time, not only their kennel mates, but also at races and training runs with other dogs and checkpoints and all of that as well. So that's just a little bit of information in regards to how they transport them. But if we could just stay on the dog thing just for a second. We talked about yesterday how healthy these dogs are and the vet care that they receive up before the race. And as you know, Alex, all of the dogs have to have vet checks. They all have to have EKG workups to check their hearts, but they also have to have a vet check that is approved by the Iditarod veterinarian before that dog can race. And I'm sure you saw the story a couple of days ago about Monica's dog, Dweezil. He has his own Instagram page. He is a rock star on social media, just rocking and rolling. He had a real rough time starting out in life. I guess she was on a race, and he almost died at one point, and he rebounded and did very well and happened to start in lead on Monica's team this year, sort of a comeback kid type moment. And when she pulled into, I believe, the checkpoint in Ruby, they did a vet check on all of the dogs, and they happened to find a very shallow heart murmur on Dweezil, and he was since dropped and flown home. But that's just the type of care that they get before, during, and after the race. So anytime people say, oh, you know, the mushers are cruel to the dogs or the dogs are not taken care of, that's absolutely false. So did you get a chance to read about or see the video of the story about Dweezil?
Yes. And you know, Dweezil, Monica Zappa is one of my favorite mushers. Is a very, very colorful and outspoken musher who's very active on social media throughout the year and just really, really cares so much for her dogs and especially for Dweezil. So this is, it's a sad thing, definitely, but on the other hand, the attitude that we can now find these things, and the veterinary care is much better now. The technology and everything has really progressed significantly in the past, you know, dozen years or so, that we can detect these things much earlier. And so even though Dweezil is most likely not going to be running competitive races anymore, this will enable him to be able to go on and lead a full, happy, and hopefully long life.
You know, and you said it right there. You hit it on the head where you said the technology has advanced so much. Just imagine being able to pick a shallow heart murmur out in all of the chaos of a checkpoint after the dog has ran however many miles from one checkpoint to the other. I'm sure he was, he was out of breath, and, you know, like any athlete would be when they pulled into a checkpoint and breathing hard and the pulse is pounding, and they were able to pick out that minute heart murmur in that kind of conditions and make that call in the middle of a race. I don't know if it was in the daytime or in the middle of the night. It's just amazing what we can do for both people and dogs in these type of situations.
Absolutely. And, you know, the for people who may be relatively new to Iditarod or may not know as much about it, there are approximately 50 trail veterinarians and a large number of vet techs who go up and down the trail in various checkpoints. And I believe they say that they do approximately 50,000 examinations of dogs on the trail while the race is going on. So it's not the case that every dog is examined at every checkpoint, but I believe the goal is to do that or get close to that. There are some instances where that just can't be done, but all of the dogs are examined to the extent that that's possible at each checkpoint when the teams come in. I wanted to mention just briefly, I don't think I said this before, the dog who died en route back to Anchorage was a 2-year-old male named Smoke, who was on Scott Smith's team. Who was dropped in Manly Hot Springs.
Right.
And keeping on this just for another second or two, there was a great article that Brian Bears wrote that was
right
on KTVA's website about dogs dying. And the point that he made was that this is always a tragedy, not only for the individual musher, but for the entire mushing community. And he tells a story in this article about how he was running Iditarod in 2015, and he was stopped with a number of other mushers at Old Woman Cabin, and Catherine Keith came in with a dog who had a lot of blood coming out of its nose and mouth. And all of the mushers jumped up to help her dog, even though none of them knew her dog, and most of them didn't really know her. They knew her from meetings and from being part of the mushing community, but they didn't really know her. But they all jumped up to help immediately, looking for where this dog might have been wounded. When they couldn't really find anything, since he had been resting the longest, he immediately went out because they were in a cabin on the trail that didn't have any communications and wasn't an official checkpoint or rest stop. So he went out, was able to flag down a snow machine crew who were able to radio a pilot and get someone to come and help Catherine's dog. And as it turned out, there was a very small puncture wound in the dog's nasal cavity that caused a lot of breathing. As with humans, head wounds tend to bleed a lot. So there was a lot of bleeding, especially because there was, you know, this was a dog who was breathing a lot as he was running. And the good news for this story, anyway, is that the dog was fine, was able to continue, and is still running today. And I just want to quote one of the things Brian said in the article. He said, "These stories don't get reported because they aren't glamorous and are left only for mushers to talk about. But the crew involved showed tremendous urgency and care for one dog located remotely out of over 1,000 dogs in a 1,000-mile race, and each one of those dogs is genuinely loved."
That's awesome. I didn't get a chance to read that article. I saw it pop up right when I was putting the cell phone to bed, so to speak. So I'll definitely have to check that out as well. All right, Alex, we are just about out of time. I'm sure we'll run over a few minutes this afternoon. We want to talk about Ryan Anderson. We mentioned him there at the top quite a bit, a rookie on the trail, currently the Red Lantern winner. And remember, if you do miss us on the live stream, you can always finish the story at any time just by downloading us over on blogtalkradio.com/dogworks and or subscribe to us on iTunes. Again, just search for Dog Works Radio. So let's talk about Ryan. What do you have for us?
Okay, so Ryan Anderson is a rookie this year. He's 35. He was born and raised in Pine City, Minnesota, and he has been around mushing since he was 5 years old. When he was five, his father heard about a couple of Alaskan mushers who had moved into the area, and his dad contacted them, and they had kennel tours. They were talking to them, and before long, the entire family was working with these kennels, feeding the dogs, taking care of the dogs, scooping the poop, and learning about what it means to raise dogs and run behind a sled. His family then started getting their own dogs, and within a year or two they had 10. He started building his own sleds when he was a little kid, completed his first race, which was a 2-miler, while he was still in elementary school. He started racing competitively when he was only 10 years old, and through middle school and high school, he spent almost every weekend from January through March competing in local races in Minnesota and Wisconsin. He moved to Pine City, Minnesota in 1999 to establish his own kennel. He and his wife, Missy, now run the Andertier Racing Kennel. They have 40 Alaskan Huskies. He ran the Junior Iditarod when he was 17, said that he was intended to come back and run the Iditarod. Took him 18 years, but he's now doing that. He has won the John Bear Grease 3 times, including in 2017, about a month ago. He's won the UP 200, which is a big race in Michigan, 6 times. He was the youngest, when he was 19, he was the youngest ever winner of the Bear Grease Mid-Distance, which is sort of the, I guess, the little brother to the Bear Grease marathon race. And he's the only musher who has won both the Bear Grease Mid-Distance and the Bear Grease Marathon, the big race. Also, he's the only musher who's ever won both the Bear Grease and the UP 200 in the same year. He works as a carpenter in the off season, and he has a special project for this year. He has a bunch of homemade or handcrafted wooden toys that he brought up with him, and he's got these toys on his sled, and he's giving out these wooden toys made by a company called TLC Toys to children in different checkpoints along the trail as a way of saying thank you for the villages supporting the Iditarod and welcoming the race every year. He has said in interviews since the race started that his team is a really great mid-distance team, that he is trying to have run a long-distance race. He said a couple of times that he feels it may have been a mistake to come up to Alaska so late, so that he didn't have a lot of time training on the trails in Alaska, and he says that if he comes up and runs Iditarod again, he's going to come up a few weeks early so that his team will have time to acclimate to Alaska and really get started and do some heavy-duty Alaskan training before the actual Iditarod starts. And he said that there's a couple of interviews with him on the Insider, and he said that at this point he's viewing this more as a training run than as a race, and he's just trying to to get through it, make sure that his dogs are well taken care of and are happy. And he said that when midway through the race, he's realized that everything is a lot bigger than you might think it was. So that goes for, you know, the mountains, the scenery, and how long the race is. And when he was asked how he felt about the temperatures, he said, "I'm fine with 20 below, but I start to have problems when it's 40 below," which I think is something that everyone feels.
Right.
You know, it seems for those of us in warmer climates, just the idea of 20 below seems impossibly cold. But I remember being in McGrath when it got down to almost 40 below, and during the day it was 10 or 15 below, and that felt fine. So compared to 40
yes.
below, 15 below is not too bad. And I would have to think that this is a good – that Ryan Anderson is a great guy to have around if you have something that needs to be fixed in a sled. Just the fact that he is – you know, he built his own sleds when he was a kid, and then he works as a carpenter. He's literally very hands-on with everything that he does. So we hear a lot about, in races, about, you know, past Iditarods, about people having problems with their sleds and having to jerry-rig some sort of solution to get broken parts of their sleds to work together. I would think that Ryan Anderson would be the ideal person to deal with a problem like that. As we mentioned in the top of the show, he is currently the Red Lantern, and he did spend that 39 hours in that checkpoint, which is frankly a little bit troublesome. But hopefully, whatever the issues are that he was having there, he's been able to deal with. And right now, just checking the tracker right now, he is going 8.4 miles per hour, which is certainly a very good speed. His moving average speed right now is 7.7 miles per hour, which is, you know, a little bit low compared to the leaders, but certainly respectable.
Yeah,
so
I was just going to say, I agree with that. That is very respectable. And like we mentioned there at the top, Alex, it could be that he was just sitting out that flu bug that was going around with the dogs. And, you know, it's very seldomly talked about because it's typically we hear about the dogs being dropped or the dogs being sick. But on many occasions, the people get sick as well, and they have to spend some time in a checkpoint longer than they thought. I guess it was last year or the year before, Rick Casillo came down with a really bad case of pneumonia and had to stay in a checkpoint for a very long time. He was at the clinic and under antibiotics and the whole nine yards. So the people get sick just like the dogs do, and that could have been the case as well, but I guess it's not our job to speculate. Very quickly, Alex, if I could add a couple of things about Ryan there, just reading his profile and hearing you talk. Yeah, the Bear Grease Marathon is known as the toughest mid-distance race outside of Alaska. It is a brutal race. It goes up the North Shore along Lake Superior from Duluth all the way up to almost the tip there near the Canadian border and back. And it is known for very cold temperatures. You get that lake effect wind coming off, and it's very comparable to Alaskan running. And he has won that three times, including this year. And the UP 200 as well is a tough race up there in the same climate there as the Bear Grease, just a couple of states over in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. But I did not know about the toys. What a Alaskan story. It's almost like he's Santa Claus coming in with his sled and his team of quote-unquote reindeer into the checkpoint and delivering toys to some of the kids. That is an awesome story, Alex. I don't know where you find these little tidbits.
That one I found on the Teacher on the Trail diary. And there's a great picture there of one of these toys, and it's like a handcrafted, I believe it's a train. It's like a handcrafted wooden train. And, you know, I remember when I was a kid, it was sort of when toys were shifting over from being these heavy wooden things to you know, mass manufactured plastic stuff. So the beginning of my childhood, there was a lot of wooden toys, but by the end of my childhood, it was almost all, you know, the plastic mass made
right.
stuff. And when I was a kid, I loved all of that plastic stuff. But now that I'm older, I have a really renewed appreciation for wooden things that are actually made by someone, as opposed to stamped out on plastic on a machine that's making, you know, 1,000 or 1,000,000 of these things.
What a cool story. And like I said, it is the Santa Claus story there on the trail. And I'm sure the kids that get those gifts will cherish those for a long time. Alex, I know we're out of time. And if just a couple of quick updates before we go. Starting tomorrow, we're going to be airing at 7 o'clock Alaska time. That will be 10 p.m. Eastern time, so you'll probably be able to catch that unless you stay up 24 hours a day like Alex does during Iditarod. You can catch that the following morning. Starting tomorrow, Michelle will be our co-host with Alex. I will be on our expedition with our group of UAA students. We're leaving today on a 150-mile expedition by dog team and fat tire bike. So if you think we're crazy, I'll tell you about it when we're back on the air on Thursday. We're looking forward to running about 40, 45 miles a day with the dog teams and on a bike. So I have to do this, Alex, because you know a little bit about our trip. What do you think about traveling on a bike, and it's currently 21 degrees, and it's supposed to be much colder tomorrow as we head northwest. What do you think about traveling on the bike for 40 miles a day in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness?
I think, actually, that sounds like an enormous amount of fun.
Excellent.
I used to do a lot of biking, not during the winter so much, but I used to do a bunch of sort of mid-distance biking. On a flat surface with a bike, you can do 40 miles with no problem. And I know people who've done 100, 120 miles per day on long bike trips. Obviously, this is a lot more difficult because you're going on ice and snow and uneven terrain. But it sounds like a wonderful, wonderful trip. The one thing, just from my biking experience, that I would be wary of is wind. I think wind rather
yes.
than cold temperatures is really going to be something that would significantly slow people down. But I can't wait to hear about it. It sounds like a wonderful, wonderful trip.
I hope so. We've been planning it for almost a year now. We've got eight students that are in the outdoor leadership program that are going along with us. All of these young kids, by my standards, most of them are young enough to be my kids, are looking forward to the adventure. One of them just showed up here at the house just about 5 minutes ago as I was on the air. So, yeah, it's going to be an awesome trip, but I want to make sure that you guys are in good hands over the next 5 days or so. I know Alex will always have the stories to tell, and Michelle will definitely bring a different perspective than you and I do. Alex, you and I have been doing this so long, we just kind of go at give and take on what each other says. So I hope you guys have a great time together over the next few days, and looking forward to hearing your guys' podcasts when I get back.
Excellent. Well, have a great trip, and may the trails be fast and the weather good.
Thank you very much, Alex. We will talk again Sunday night, 7 o'clock. Michelle and Alex will be on Mushing Radio and our Day 7 coverage of the 2017 Iditarod. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.